everyone. Well, welcome to Stutter Talk, episode 601 for October 17th, 2016, the fact-checking edition. I am Peter Reitzis in Carr Carver, North Carolina, using some good voluntary fake pseudo-stuttering, and I have on the line via Skype Craig Coleman in West Virginia. Hey, Craig.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
I am great. I love following you on Facebook because you're a baseball dad, and I love to see all of the Little League pictures. That's awesome.
Yeah, we definitely stay busy with baseball.
Very cool. It feels like a dying sport here in North Carolina, so I'm glad to see it on my Facebook feed.
I wonder if that's just because it's too hot all the time there.
Ah, good point, sir. Craig Coleman is an assistant professor at Marshall University and a board-certified specialist in fluency disorders. Mr. Coleman is currently serving as coordinator of ASHA's SIG 4 group on fluency. That's the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association special interest group on fluency. Mr. Coleman is an adjunct instructor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania and co-director of the Stuttering You Summer Program for children who stutter, their families, and SLPs. You are everywhere with stuttering, Craig, and it's great to follow you, man.
Thanks, Peter. I appreciate that. You do such a great work with the podcast here. It's a great resource for my students, the families of the kids we see in our clinic. So thank you.
Well, that's great to hear, man. So today on Stutter Talk, Craig Coleman and I will discuss the book Voice Unearthed, Hope, Help, and a Wake-Up Call for the Parents of Children Who Stutter by Doreen Holte. This book is a quick read at just over 100 pages. Craig, I think I read the book in like 2 or 3 hours, right?
Yeah, when I got it, that's about the time it took me to read it too. It was about 2 or 3 hours, I would say.
Okay, great. So in her introduction, and so Doreen Holte is the parent of a child who stutters. And in her introduction, Holte writes, "This book is primarily for parents so they can become better advocates for their children who stutter." And for me, one of the most powerful messages of the book is keep them talking. That is, keep people who stutter talking and help prevent silence and avoidance. And that's a really important message. So Craig and I are going to discuss the strengths of Dory's book and our concerns about the book. A good part of this episode will be fact-checking the book. Stutter Talk has invited Dory Holte to come on air for a future episode. Hopefully we can bring you that conversation in the coming weeks. So Craig, I'm going to give you and the listeners a very brief overview or perhaps book review of the book, and then I'm going to turn it over to you with a lot of questions. Does that sound okay to you?
That sounds perfect.
All right. So Dory Holte, I think, is at her strongest when she shares the frustration and desperation she experienced early on taking her son Eli to speech therapy. Dory's deep love for Eli is touching. Holte's book highlights her tireless dedication to her son Eli. For example, driving her son long distances to speech therapy and attending self-help conferences around the country. In my opinion, the weakest and frankly most troublesome aspects of Holte's book occurred during some of her discussions about self-help or organizations and the field of speech language pathology. In my opinion, by far the most valuable parts of Holte's book is when she very movingly at times discusses attending speech therapy with her son and watching him shut down. There's a lot of pain in the book and she captures it beautifully at times. So I do want to congratulate her on sharing this very personal experience of hers. So on page 9 of Voice Unearthed, Holte describes a joyous time in which Eli was communicating happily and easily with her, his mother, and his speech sounded, quote, mostly normal. Holte then wrote, 3 days later, I told our therapist how wonderful that time had been, and she asked me if I had praised him for his fluency. I was appalled. For one thing, she had never suggested that I do this before. For another, I felt instinctively that to make that moment about his speech would have been the worst thing I could have done. Our time together had been about so much more than his stutter. In May 2003, after our fourth speech therapist, we decided to take a break. So I've put a lot on the table, Craig, what do you make of that experience I just shared where she tells the speech pathologist that she just had some great conversations with her son and the speech pathologist says, did you congratulate him on not stuttering?
You know, I think that would be incredibly frustrating as a parent. To be honest, it's a little bit frustrating as a speech pathologist who works with kids who stutter to read that, because as speech pathologists, we want to support the parents. And I think this is one of the points that comes through in the book very well, and you highlighted this already, is the keep them talking motto. And so it's very hard to focus on the keep them talking motto if we're basically giving them feedback solely on whether they're fluent or not. So, I mean, the message to me of that whole statement as a speech therapist is not so much, oh, are you praising fluency, but wow, that's great that he was able to have that type of conversation with you.
Yes, I totally agree. And I want to pull out a few more things that she shares in the book that I found very moving and important before we get into fact-checking. But before I do that, was there anything in the book you saw that you thought was powerful that you'd like to share with us?
You know, I think the whole journey to me was powerful. And I think it really does, in a lot of ways, I do wish that, I know she wrote this book for parents, but there's part of me that wishes that speech pathologists would read this book, especially students, because I think that it would help them to be able to see a parent's perspective and, you know, what you would be able to focus on as a speech pathologist that's not going to drive the parent away from wanting to do therapy. And I think that came across several times in the book of just the frustration that chasing fluency brought on.
Yes, and I agree with that with one caution that if students do read the book, I would want them to have somebody like you teaching them who could then discuss some of the things in the book that you might disagree with, because there are a number of comments in the book that we'll get to that I found troubling, and I think students should hear from others on these topics. And the book we're discussing is Voice Unearthed by Doreen Holte, and it was published in 2011. And I want to share another thing she wrote that I thought was particularly moving. On pages 16 to 17, Holte writes, "How long was I supposed to keep dragging Eli from therapist to therapist?" She goes on to say, "Sometimes I felt that we just have to keep going and going and going, just like the Energizer Bunny. But I was out of energy and we were just about out of hope. It was beginning to seem as if the burden of incorporating speech techniques into Eli's world was proving to be a far greater burden than the stuttering itself." And we hear things like that a lot, right, Craig?
Yeah, I think that's a really good gauge of how the therapy process is going. I think as a parent, you should really be able to view speech therapy or that time as, number one, a time where you're hopefully your child is learning and you're learning. It may not be every week that the child is making, you know, remarkable progress in terms of their fluency or ability to use strategies, but you should walk away with a good feeling that you're learning something, and each time that you go, hopefully you walk away feeling more calm than when you came in. And I think if you leave there each time feeling like you're just with a greater burden, I think that's probably a sign that the relationship is not working very well.
Yes, well said. And when I said we hear that a lot, what I specifically meant was that we hear from a number of people who stutter that sometimes, not always, but sometimes it feels that using a strategy to manage stuttering seems harder than just stuttering. And I know as a person who stutters myself that seemed very true to me at times. Sometimes it was just easier to stutter than to think about how I was going to talk. And let me share one more thing that Dory has said. So she was on the Pam Mertz podcast talking about her book. And Holte says, asking a child to use speech tools and techniques, if this is something they are not able to do easily in their everyday setting, which quite honestly, I've never met one kid who is able to do that easily, the chances of them experiencing that as failure over and over and over again, and the shame that builds up around that is breathtaking. It's breathtaking. And as a parent, to me, it's not worth that risk. And I think she pulls out something important here, is that I've certainly heard for the past 16 years as a speech language pathologist, some of my colleagues say or assume that because you can use a speech tool in the speech room, in the speech office, that you can then go into the classroom or into a public space and use the speech tool. And it's much, much harder to do that. So, I mean, is this something that you hear about too, Craig?
Yeah, definitely. And I also think, you know, going along with that, in addition to being different to use it out in public or to use it in different environments than the speech clinic, you have to keep in mind that when we look at what fluency is, you know, there's the smooth, forward-flowing speech aspect of it, but there's also an effort aspect of fluency. And if somebody can maintain their fluency very well, but they have to work exceptionally hard to do it, you do have to ask yourself if it's really fluent speech or if it's just an artificial speech that's really masking what's going on.
Yeah, I keep saying this, but I totally agree. And then I think we also have to ask ourselves, how important is it that we speak without stuttering all the time? You know, but that's something that comes up a lot too. So we've pulled out some positive aspects of Dory's book. And I just want to say again, I think the book is at its strongest when she's talking about her own experiences as a mom of a child who stutters and her journey. So we're going to move into some fact-checking of the book now. I want to remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk. I'm Peter Reitzes here with Craig Coleman. And Craig, you keep great company. I mean, you hang out with Scott Yaris and Bob Quisel, so you're around royalty, right?
Well, yeah, you know, if you surround yourself with the best, it rubs off on you eventually.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so on the very first page of the book, so in the introduction to the book, Holte quotes and discusses an article by Kalinowski and colleagues. In fact, she talks about this article from 2005 throughout the paper. So here's what she quotes Kalinowski and colleagues saying at the very beginning of the book. Speech and language therapists treating the... Okay, so Kalinowski and colleagues, they did a survey of 101 speech language pathologists in North Carolina, who work with people who stutter. So here's the quote. Speech and language therapists treating these children either do not possess the tools or the tools do not yet exist to change nature's recovery agenda and put children who stutter on the path towards natural sounding, fluent, and spontaneous speech in all situations. The reported recovery rate suggests that not much is being done therapeutically to help children recover from stuttering. And then Holte concludes the continued failure of most speech therapy provided to children who stutter is the elephant in the room. So what do you make of how Holte begins her book?
Well, this is where I guess there's a sort of a disconnect for me, because, you know, I do understand a lot of her plight as a parent and her frustration in not being able to find, seemingly for a long time, an approach that worked for her child or a therapist that was a good match for her child. And that comes across very well in the book, and I think that really hits home to me as a speech pathologist and also someone who trains students. But there does seem to be a disconnect here where, on the one hand, we're talking about trying to let children talk and not chasing fluency all the time. And then on the other hand, kind of looking at it based on this definition by Kalinowski, that if you don't achieve fluent speech, that therapy is somehow failing. And I don't know that you can have it both ways there.
Yeah, she does seem to be wanting to have it both ways. So at the same time, she's pushing back against this chasing fluency. She also seems to be saying speech therapy has failed because it hasn't made people fluent. It hasn't cured people. And to just to go to the original article by Kalinowski and his colleagues, they write, the provision of therapy in North Carolina, at least, does not yet allow for stuttering children to shed the label of stutterer in their own eyes and in the eyes of all others for the rest of their lives. Well, when I work with school-aged children who stutter, I'm not looking to do that. Are you looking to do that?
No, I think that really sets people up for failure. I mean, you know, you can take almost any chronic health condition, and whether we want to say we're talking about disabilities or non-disabilities, we're still talking about some condition that people have. And there are a lot of health conditions that people have where the goal is not to shed the name of the health condition or lose it forever. I mean, I'm always going to be a person who is nearsighted. You know, I can have glasses that will help me. I will have contacts that will help me. There's nothing I can do to shed that label for myself. You know, somebody who has asthma is always going to have asthma. There's not going to be a thing that they can do that just gets rid of that label. I think we, you know, this is part of our challenge that we have in stuttering, is that, you know, there are people who so want so bad not to be labeled as a person who stutters that they look for programs or cures or things like that and will do almost anything to get rid of that label, when the label itself is not the problem. We should be looking at much more of what the impact is on the person's life and less on what the title of the disorder just happens to be, in my opinion.
Wow, very wise words. And I would pursue that, except the listeners at home can't see our 9 pages of possible things to talk about. So I'm just going to keep pushing right along. So to quote something from page 86 of Voice Unearthed, here's what Dory wrote. Remember, there is no evidence that children are more apt to recover with direct therapy. There is far more evidence that direct therapy contributes to increased anxiety. Do you agree with that, Craig?
You know, I've never had a kid who got worse in therapy. I mean, you know, you do have some, for whatever reason, from time to time, who may not make as much progress as you want them to make. Honestly, if kids are getting more anxious about their stuttering in therapy, I don't think something right is being done. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, because, again, from her personal experience, that may have been her personal experience in therapy. But to then generalize that to say, you know, therapy in general contributes to more anxiety and unwanted behaviors, I am not aware of any evidence that that exists.
Yeah, and I think that Ms. Holte might be making the same mistake that some people who stutter make, which is to universalize their experience to everyone else's. And I'm always very careful not to do that. You know, my stuttering experience is my stuttering experience. And I deeply respect her journey and her joys and frustrations and pains. And she says a lot of things very beautifully in her book. But I throughout the book, there are these times where I think she's universalizing her experience to other people. And I should add, I mean, I know she's not a speech language pathologist, but when she says something like that, I think she should cite it. And she didn't do that. So I'm sort of wondering, you know, well, what would be the citation there? You know, I'm not aware of one. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but are you?
Well, no, I'm not. And, you know, there's, as a person who's sitting here, you know, and I read the book and I'm reading that comment and I'm thinking about that comment. And even as you're saying it again, does it happen? I am sure beyond a shadow of a doubt that it does. I mean, you know, it would make perfect sense to me if you have somebody who's going through a program that only focuses on fluency all the time, that probably would happen in a lot of cases, where people would become more self-conscious, more anxious, more reluctant to speak as they go through therapy. So in no way am I denying that happens, but I do think that you have to look at and say, and I think this is the point that she sometimes misses in her book, is that it's not about speech therapy in general and people who stutter in general. It's about the clinical relationship that that particular client has with that particular clinician. And really, that's going to be you know, what you look at and say, is a person able to make improvement, and is the therapeutic relationship a positive one? And I just don't think you can generalize that to all clients.
So let me read the quote to you one more time, just so that I could bring up a different point from the quote. So Holte writes, "Remember, there is no evidence that children are more apt to recover with direct therapy. There is far more evidence that direct therapy contributes to increased anxiety." Well, Lidcombe treatment for preschoolers who stutter is, it could very well be the most researched treatment in stuttering ever, and that's considered a direct therapy. And I think that people who develop that would take issue with this idea that a direct therapy such as Lidcombe would contribute to increased anxiety. And I think she's a little sloppy in the book, where she's not distinguishing between different age groups. So if you're talking about preschool stuttering, then I even more disagree with her statement. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I completely agree that preschool and school age is very different. I mean, so you're not going to have really any school age adolescent kids who go through indirect therapy. I mean, you know, by the time a kid gets to be 7 and 8, I'm not really sure how you can do therapy without talking about stuttering for stuttering. And I know we're going to get to that a little bit later, more in depth. But when you look at this distinction here, I mean, to me, there's even, you know, you can certainly make the argument that Lidcombe has more data than any other program that is out there for stuttering. And that's a very direct and even beyond direct program in terms of it being more operant than direct even. So, I mean, if you're talking about, like, you know, an operant program not making it worse for kids, I'm not really sure that I would buy that a direct program where you're just talking about stuttering and teaching kids strategies makes it worse. Now, again, in the hands of somebody who doesn't have any experience treating stuttering and doesn't have any interest in learning about it, could that happen? Yes, I think it could. But does it happen for every child? And should you take that experience then and say, well, kids should never get therapy? I think that's a big stretch.
So to close this part out, do you think it's fair to say that she's bringing up a good and valid point, she's just overstating it?
Yes, absolutely. That would be a good way to describe it, I think. I think her point is, I mean, from reading this and kind of getting what I was going originally, when I first sat down and read it, my first thought was, she's right about a lot of this, but she's not expressing it in a way that's going to be able to be generalized to other people. And I think describing her situation maybe a little bit more, talking about, what are some factors that you might look for in terms of, is a clinician pushing the fluency approach a little bit too much and not working or caring about reactions as much? I think that would have been a little bit more helpful versus some of these just strong overgeneralizations, and maybe more of a focus on, if I have a child in therapy and I'm a parent, what can I look for in therapy to tell me, is this a good approach or is this an approach where I might want to back away from?
Yeah, and it is important what she set out to do, which is to write a book, a parent speaking to other parents. I just wished, frankly, I wish she would have had an editor who would have caught some of this stuff, or perhaps steered her to make some changes like we're discussing. And I want to let the listeners know that the reason that I'm talking to you about this before Dory is that she's asked over the years a few times to come on Stutter Talk, and before I have her on air, I do think that for Stutter Talk, the responsible thing to do is to first discuss the strengths and some of our concerns and then have her on, because the same way that she wants to get a message out to parents, I want to make sure that the message that Stutter Talk is presenting to the world, to the stuttering community, is one that, I can stand behind. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is now, so for those who have the book Voice Unearthed, this is from page 12. So Dory's son was instructed to do many things in speech therapy, and in her book, she lists 11 such things, such as, quote, think about breathing, think about what his tongue was doing, think about what his lips were doing, pay attention to how the listener was reacting, and it goes on to list more things. And Holte concludes, quote, you try it. I mean it right now. Put down the book, go to your partner or family member or neighbor or friend and do all of these things while holding a conversation. If you fail, stop, start over, and keep using these strategies. Do this for even a day, and I guarantee that you will acquire a stutter. And I read that and thought, wow, did she really just say that? Because I'm not sure if she's joking or not. And when she's writing to parents, I don't know how a parent can interpret that. I mean, I think parents could just take that at face value. I mean, did that concern you at all, Craig?
Yeah, again, I think it's another situation where her point is a valid one. I mean, like, you know, if I, when I sit there and read those things, you know, to try to see what your lips are doing, what your tongue's doing, breathe. I mean, are those going to be exhausting things? Are they going to make people not want to talk as much? Yes, I believe that's true. Are they going to turn people into a person who stutters? No, I don't believe that's true. I mean, these are things that I've talked to parents about before, about how hard it is for kids to use strategies all the time. And I'll say to them, imagine yourself having to do that. Or, you know, I've had my students do these types of exercises just so they know how hard it is to do them. Does anybody turn into a person who stutters? No. But do they really, they get a good sense of how frustrating it can be? Yeah, I think they do.
And I'm hoping that the speech therapist or therapists who assign these tools weren't suggesting the person do them all at the same time, because that would be overwhelming. But I mean, so when you read all 11, did you kind of get that feeling like, wow, we're really asking a lot of kids, a lot of children, or did you get a different feeling?
No, I did get that feeling. And I think it goes back to what we talked about before. I mean, so even if you have a kid who gets to the point, if they're using all 11 of those strategies, and now they get to the point where they're completely fluent all the time, there does become a question for a lot of kids. And I think everyone would answer it a different way, is that worth it? And I think not everybody would agree one way or the other if it was worth it. And I think what you would probably see over time is even the people who thought it was worth it would probably wear down over time by doing that many different techniques.
Yeah, and I think any one of those things to look at, like stretching out words or to think about and plan what he was going to say before he said it, I think any one of those things is just fine. It's just, I certainly wouldn't want to suggest that somebody has to do those things so that they don't stutter. I mean, the amount of pressure that puts on a person, but I mean, how else can we change how we talk if we're not thinking about how we talk? I don't know if that makes sense to you or not, Craig, but...
Well, it does. And I think it goes back to this, the central argument of this book is that to me, there's a, you know, a couple different things here. I mean, there's the focus is put so much on the strategies, and again, as a parent, I think that can be incredibly frustrating because on the one hand, you are getting the message, or maybe she wasn't getting the message. I don't know from the therapist that she had, but supposedly you're getting the message that it's okay to stutter, and then on the other hand, just do these 11 things so you don't. I do think it creates a situation where, you know, you have to present it to kids in a way where you can say things like, you know, these are some strategies to use when you feel like you want to use them, when you feel like you need to use them. But everybody has to know very early on in the therapy process, the amount of times that they actually use these probably is going to be relatively small.
Hmm. Yeah. And she really at times is a gifted writer. I mean, so she makes that list, and the very last thing on the list is relax, which is funny, you know, because you're told to do all these things and then told to relax. And she could have ended that part in many different ways. I mean, she could have just observed, hey, speaking's supposed to be fun, right? We're supposed to enjoy talking. But instead, she says, you try all of these things, and I guarantee you will stutter. And I, you know, a parent who's reading this book might not know better. They might take that at face value. And I'm just, I wish she wouldn't have written that. This is Stutter Talk. Peter Reitz is here with Craig Coleman. Craig has his hands in a lot of stuttering hats. I don't know how you sleep. I don't know how you find time to sleep, Craig. So in the book Voice Unearthed, Holte talks about attending a 2004 National Stuttering Association annual conference, and she mentions the stuttering iceberg. Could you briefly remind the listeners what the iceberg analogy of stuttering is?
Sure. So the iceberg analogy was developed by Joshi and back in the early 1970s, might have been 1970. And what Sheehan described as the iceberg analogy was that there is the part of stuttering that we can all see and hear. That's the surface level disfluencies, the physical tension, the secondary behaviors. But then there's the whole part of stuttering that lies under the surface that is not easy to see from another perspective. The guilt, the fear, the shame, the avoidance of talking, the negative reactions that someone has. And Sheehan's argument was that that is a much bigger aspect of stuttering for people, and we tend to focus much more on the much smaller part that we see on the surface.
Yeah, and I think we would agree that overemphasizing the smaller part, the stuttering behaviors at the top, can be very unproductive or negative in a person's life.
Absolutely.
So Holte discusses this 2004 National Stuttering Association conference, and she on page 13, and she writes, "The choices didn't seem to go beyond choosing fluency shaping and stuttering modification strategies. With the exception of one workshop by Russ Hicks," Holte asks, "why was the rest of the conference focused on blasting off the top of the iceberg," she means, "when it was creating a bigger problem?" So she suggests that somehow the 2004 National Stuttering Association conference was all about the tip of the iceberg. And when I read that, I just immediately thought that can't be true. That just can't be true. So I went back and I found the conference program from that year. And let me read you, Craig, just a few of the things from that year. Covert Stuttering Exposed, a workshop. These are all workshops. On the Road to Recovery, Acceptance and Appreciation of Your Stuttering. Get More Stuttering Support from Your Spouse. Stuttering in Film, Television, and Media. Toastmasters Workshop. Advertising Your Stuttering. Passing Twice, Gay Men, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Persons Who Stutter and Their Allies. What I Wish I Had Told My Therapist, and on and on and on. Would you agree that those titles of those workshops don't really sound like tip of the iceberg stuff?
Yeah, I think, you know, the titles that you read there, and just based on my own experiences with going to NSA conferences over the years, they're pretty diverse in terms of the experiences that you get. I mean, I would not say at all that they are focused just on the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there is something for everybody, and usually there's something for everybody in terms of adults who stutter and children who stutter and SLPs. It's really a good opportunity where people have to come together to talk about much more than just surface level behavior.
Yeah. So she does say in the book some other nice things about self-help, and she says some things I disagree with, but it worries me that a parent reading this might think, oh, the NSA might not be for us. It's all about the tip of the iceberg. And I have to wonder what was going on when she attended that conference that she would write that. Or I mean, again, just looking, I've been to a number of NSA conferences and events, and that just hasn't been my experience. And the list of workshops suggests something very different than what she describes in her book. So, I do hope if there's a future edition of the book that she will change that or think about changing that.
You know, I think one other factor there we have to think about too is that I'm not really sure where her son was in the process of therapy at that particular time in 2004 when they went to the conference. If they were still at a place where they thought that the goal of therapy was to be fluent all the time, it may be that they chose to attend sessions to work on improving fluency. You know, a lot of times people will only go to the things that they're really ready for. And I do think that's something to think about, too, as people can, you know, reflect back on their own experiences or a conference or something like that. People attend really what they are ready for.
I agree with you, But I'm looking at the list of workshops right now, and I'm not seeing much about just working on stuttering at all. I mean, like, there's a presentation on the Speakeasy. Now, I didn't go to that one, but I imagine that stutterer after stutterer stood up and said, it hasn't helped me that much, because in past conferences, that's what I've heard. So I hear what you're saying. It just seems that the overwhelming amount of the presentations that year were not based on the tip of the iceberg. And you know what I'll do? I'll put the link to the 2004 conference program at stuttertalk.com episode 601 so people can see it themselves.
You know what? I agree with you completely about that. I mean, I wasn't saying that it was based on that. What I'm saying is, like a lot of other parts of the book, I think that the book was written from her own perspective. And so if they went to these select few sessions that focused on fluency, I think it could have been very easy for her to come back and write about just those few sessions that she went to without even knowing there was a bigger part of the conference going on, because that might be what they were focused on going to.
Yeah, that is really an excellent point, because when I go to these conferences, I don't really tend to go to the ones that are working on changing speech. I mean, I might, but I generally would go more to the passing twice workshop or the covert stuttering workshop and things like that, or Toastmasters and stuff like that. So on page 22, she writes this: "The stuttering modification therapy provided to school-aged children today stems from Van Riper's MidVis approach, yet Van Riper never worked with children." Now, that's just not true. Van Riper absolutely worked with children. He worked a lot with children. I think he was well known for working more with adults, but he's one of the founders of the field of speech language pathology. He's a stutterer himself. Dory Holte even cites a paper of Van Riper's in which he talks about working with children. So it's just not true when she writes Van Riper never worked with children. But I think the point she's trying to do is to dismiss stuttering modification therapy with children, which is, to oversummarize it, stuttering modification is not chasing fluency, it's stuttering differently, stuttering more easily, talking about stuttering, using a pull out like I just showed now. What do you make of that part of the book and her idea that this idea, it feels like she's dismissing this type of treatment with kids?
Well, I think it goes back to the disconnect again, because I think, you know, if we look at what stuttering modification actually is, first of all, let me say that the current ideas of stuttering modification aren't solely based only on Van Riper theory and Van Riper techniques. I think what we do to work on stuttering modification and desensitization has actually expanded a lot since Van Riper. And that is one area of the book that does concern me a lot, is it seems like there's a lot of focus placed on Van Riper approaches and Wendell Johnson. And with all due respect to Van Riper and Wendell Johnson, the field is at a very different place now than it was when Van Riper and Wendell Johnson were practicing. And so I think that presents a couple problems. Number one, it presents a problem with just being current. And number two, it goes back to the disconnect again. You know, stuttering modification is not chasing fluency, as you pointed out. There's a lot of different things that go into stuttering modification, but the goal of stuttering modification is to let the child know that they can feel okay about it.
And that's really important, right?
It's the hallmark of therapy to me. I mean, you know, in order to work on stuttering modification techniques, you have to be stuttering in the first place in most cases. And so, you know, you're not creating an atmosphere for the child where they feel like they have to be fluent all the time. You're creating an atmosphere where you are telling the child that it's okay to stutter, and it's even good if they stutter, because that's really the only way they can work on stuttering modification.
So just a quick sidetrack here. So you are co-director of the Stuttering You Summer Program for Children Who Stutter. Is that West Virginia?
So we run that program out of Marshall University, and we have a 3-day summer program every year for children who stutter and their parents. And then we also have a 2-day program for speech pathologists that's a continuing education program. That's the Stuttering You program.
And do you incorporate stuttering modification ideas into that program at all?
We do. One of the first things we have kids do during that program is we have kids go out on campus with our students in different places and work on using stuttering modification strategies, stuttering on purpose, on like a treasure hunt activity or a scavenger hunt where they have to go, you know, ask the people at Starbucks for clues and things like that. So we get them into that right away and to you know, work on helping them go out, talk freely, and also get their stuttering out there.
So part of the speech therapy is asking them to stutter because stuttering's okay.
Exactly.
And I'm not going to quote it right now, but throughout her book, Dori Holte writes that this is confusing to kids, that they can be told you can stutter less and you can also stutter on purpose, you can stutter more. Isn't in your experience, are those two messages confusing to kids?
No, I don't think they are. I mean, you know, because it's, again, it's like a lot of other conditions that we have. I mean, if you're talking to a diabetic, you can tell them it's okay to be a diabetic. It's also okay to be in good control of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And this topic has been coming up a bit in the stuttering community. And I've always been okay. Well, since I started speech therapy and self-help, I've always been okay with stuttering less and stuttering more. And the two do work for me, and I'm open, very open to the possibility and to the reality that that doesn't work for others, but it does work for me and for many other people who I've met. Okay, moving right along. So on page 29 of Voice Unearthed, Holte quotes Barry Guitar, who is a very well-known speech-language pathologist. He's a well-known researcher. He's really well-liked in the stuttering community, and he's a person who stutters. So she quotes Barry Guitar as saying, quote, "Stuttering therapy is an obscure blend of techniques applied to a baffling problem with frequent failure." It's a really juicy quote, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And then, so we were sort of wondering about that, you know, as we were preparing this show. And then I went to the original Barry Guitar quote, and he mentions in that publication that he was being facetious in saying that, and that it's something that one might say during a cynical moment. So in other words, Guitar was joking. But she quotes it not as a joke. She quotes it as him being serious, and I find that troubling. I mean, if somebody says this is something you might say in a cynical moment, this is facetious, I think you should report it as such. You shouldn't report it as a fact. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a couple places in the book, this being one where she takes some things out of context. And I think this is where maybe the lack of background in speech pathology comes in sometimes, of not being able to explain the quote or to understand maybe the facetiousness that comes with the quote. I mean, you know, if I'm reading that, and I will say that when I did read it in the book, my first reaction was, that's not a helpful quote.
right. And I could ask you about that, but I kind of don't want to, because I mean, it's fair game if a leader in our field said that and meant it. But I don't think he meant it. I think he was very clear. This is facetious. So I just wish she would have reported the context of that. I feel like I think you just said it. I feel like she took it out of context. Let me remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk. I'm Peter Reitzes here with Craig Coleman. Craig is an assistant professor at Marshall University, a board-certified specialist in fluency disorders. There's only like 200 to 250 of you board-certified specialists, so you are a rare commodity, Craig.
You know, I think there's only about 157 left now.
Oh, okay. So good to be corrected on that.
We're kind of like dinosaurs, I think.
Wow, you're a young dinosaur, Craig. okay, on page 64 on Voice Unearthed, Doreen Holte writes this, quote, "Disfluencies are the least disturbing characteristics of someone struggling with stuttering." What do you think of that quote, Craig?
Again, I think it's a bit of an overgeneralization, because I think for a lot of people who stutter, they would agree with that. I think there are some people who stutter that would tell you that the disfluencies are the most disturbing characteristic for them. Everybody's experience is so different. And I know that's one area that she talked about both in the blog and the book. It seems to me that she kind of takes offense sometimes when people say you have to tailor the therapy to the individual, and she asks a lot what that really means. Well, this is a good example. I mean, you have to know what is the most disturbing characteristic of someone who stutters in terms of their struggle, and the only way to know that for sure is to find out about that particular individual, because everybody's different.
It's always good to be reminded to individualize treatment and to value, as you just said, the experience of all people who stutter. And for some people who stutter, as you just said, for many people who stutter, it's just not true. I mean, you meet people who stutter who say, you know, the most difficult part about this is the physical stuttering. You meet people who say, I'm okay with stuttering. It's just really painful to stutter all the time. It's frustrating for me. Okay, moving right along. And I just want to remind the listeners that by the time you hear this, but you're hearing my voice now, I will have invited Doreen Hulte on air to discuss this book. Again, I wanted to fact check the book first with Craig, because as president and host of Stutter Talk, I think that's the responsible thing to do. But I'm going to ask Doreen to read from her book, and I'm going to give her a chance to respond to all this, and I'm going to talk about her really valuable and important experience. So at one point in her book, on page 65, Hulte says, quote, "Few parents tell their children who begin to stutter, stop doing that." Now, I've been a speech language pathologist for 16 years, and one of the things I find is that when a family really starts to trust you, they will tell you things. They'll share with you their shame, and they'll share with you how painful you can, they'll cry, you can feel the heaviness in the room, and they'll say, when he started stuttering, I would just yell at him. It was so scary. I would yell, stop, don't talk like that. And they need to tell you that. And then as the therapist, I can say, it's so great that you're here in my office and you're trying to do better. And thank you for sharing that with me. I don't want to be too nitpicky here, but when she says things like few parents tell their children who begin to stutter, stop doing that. I mean, is that your experience too, Craig?
No, I think that, if I could give you a percentage, I'd say that 99% of the parents who come into our clinic that I've seen over, I've also been a speech therapist now for 16 years. And in 16 years, I would say 99% of parents who come in say they tell their child to slow down or think about what they want to say if they stutter. And I will tell parents that's the natural reaction of everybody, and it's okay to have done that. You know, here's what we're going to do now more productively. But I agree with you 100%. I mean, the more people feel comfortable with you, the more vulnerable they will be with you and tell you about how they really react when they do get frustrated at times, because stuttering can be incredibly frustrating to the person who has it. It can also be really scary and frustrating for the parents, too.
Yeah, I will never forget the time, really towards the beginning of my career, that a couple came in and the dad was so upset, and he admitted in speech therapy that he had hit his child once for stuttering, and he loved his child so much. And he said, I was just so scared, and I just wanted it to stop because I wanted him not to be in pain. And he needed a safe space to say it, and he just needed forgiveness, and he was so mad at himself, like the guilt he was carrying around. So as I'm reading this book as a parent, and I know Hulte didn't mean anything like this, but I wish she hadn't have wrote that, because I kind of feel you need to give parents space to make mistakes and to do better. And when a parent reads that parents don't say things like stop doing that, well, in my experience, they do. And you want to give them a space where they can tell you and you can acknowledge it, and you can acknowledge all the good that they're doing too. Does that make sense to you, Craig?
I totally agree, 100%.
So, Craig, this is on page 83 of Voice Unearthed. And so Jory Holt's talking about the National Stuttering Association, and she says, the NSA encourages, quote, the child to give a classroom presentation about the use of speech techniques. Now the child is surrounded by the speech cops, adding layers of anxiety and risking increasing silence and disengagement as the pressure for perfect speech grows. Craig, in your experience, when kids present about stuttering to their classmates with their speech language pathologist, is it that negative?
You know, from my experience, it's overwhelmingly positive when kids do presentations to their class, because it really helps the class to become educated about it, and it really takes the mystery out of it. I think taking this position that she has here assumes that the class doesn't already know the child stutters. And in most cases, unless the child is a really covert stutterer, in most cases, the class is already very well aware of the fact that the kid stutters. And so it's not bringing attention to it from the class perspective in a sense of, okay, now you have to all monitor him to see how he's talking. It's more bringing attention to it from a class standpoint to say, it's important for him to work on acceptance, but it's also important for you all to work on acceptance.
Now, I've worked in one elementary school in Brooklyn for just over 10 years, and for one elementary school in North Carolina now, this is my sixth year. I've done a lot of these presentations with kids. I can't recall a single, quote, bad experience. What I find is that when we present on stuttering to a class, when I walk into the class the next time, every child wants to come to speech therapy.
Yeah.
Every child becomes an ally. Now, granted, you know, it's best if you do this well and you don't mess it up and go into the class and demand total fluency of the child who stutters. I mean, that's not what this is about. But I've just had so many amazing experiences where I'll do this and then the child asks to bring 3, 4, 5, 6 friends to speech therapy. And, you know, I remember one time this just happens to be the time, because we don't always work on speech tools, but we were teaching speech tools to the friends of the child. And one of their friends is like, wow, this is really hard. I didn't know this was so hard. Like, really valuing the experience of the child who stutters. And then when you can do a project where you're working with the friends about researching people who stutter, like just for example, Jack Welch, or Tavis Smiley, and they get to read about people who stutter who are successful and the challenges that they've faced. I don't know. I think it's really cool and really valuable. So I haven't seen this negative experience.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, doing that, as you said, it helps build advocates for the child, which are important even when you talk about teasing and bullying and being able to address that and building support of bystanders in those situations for the child. And I also think it's another thing to demystify it. I mean, you know, a lot of the negative connotations come from stuttering because people don't understand it very well or know about it. Anytime you have the opportunity to take that mystery away, I think it's a positive thing.
Yeah, that's a really important point to pull out, to demystify stuttering, to normalize the stuttering, to show everybody that it's okay to talk like this, and we're allowed to talk to y'all about this. I mean, that's awesome. We just had a parent come into my school and he wanted to do a presentation with the school and his child about autism so that the kids in the class would better understand autism and his child's autism. You know, I just think it's really interesting how it seems that as a whole, our country, our society is getting very more willing to do these things. So I embrace these things.
Yep, I agree.
Okay, so one more thing that we can talk about a bunch of more things. On page 85 of Voice Unearthed, Holte discusses what speech therapy might look like. Quote, instead of counting speech errors, parents and therapists focus on the number of times the child interrupts. The more is better. Do you agree with that children who stutter should be allowed and encouraged to interrupt?
You know, I'm really not sure what the premise of that is, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't think that, to me, if you're going to take the focus off of stuttering and say we shouldn't be talking about counting speech errors, there's a large part of me, believe me, that agrees completely with her on that. But I think we need to put the focus then on how much is the child talking, not how much are they interrupting. Because, I mean, interrupting in and of itself leads to pragmatic difficulty. So I'm not really sure we should encourage that as much as we should just normal communication.
And again, not to be too nitpicky, but as a stutterer myself, I learned when I was a child, and I used to do this in school, in high school, and even in college, that sometimes I wouldn't stutter if I interrupted or if I started to speak while someone else was talking. I don't know if that's the masking effect or something like that. And I've talked to other stutterers who've had this experience too, that it might seem a little rude, but being a little rude is okay if we can use it as a trick to not stutter. So I just nice to be aware of these things, because we wouldn't want to accidentally teach a child who stutters an unproductive coping mechanism.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it takes the focus up for the child off of, you also can't become, you're also not as good of a listener or as good of a communicator if you're focusing on interrupting all the time.
Yeah, agreed. So Craig, in addition to the Voice Unearthed book, Dori Holte has a Voice Unearthed blog, and I think now she's more active in the Facebook group. So on the blog, she has an entry titled, "Oh, You Are Such a Good Talker." And she writes, quote, "I seriously cannot fathom any scenario where it would be appropriate and safe to praise a child for fluent talking. It's just not worth the risk." Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but Lidcombe treatment for preschoolers is verbal contingencies, as you said earlier, saying things like, "That was nice, smooth talking." So it's based on praising the child for easy talking. And the developers of Lidcombe would say, we've proven that this is safe. And many good speech language pathologists use Lidcombe, including myself. I've been open that I integrate it sometimes. So what do you think of her thought here that she cannot fathom any scenario where it would be appropriate and safe to praise a child for fluent talking?
You know, the funny thing about this discussion, I think, is that, or the ironic part, I guess, is that, and I'm going to say this from a perspective of somebody who's not really pro Lidcombe, in terms of the response contingencies and using that particular approach. I think, though, if you're not pro Lidcombe, I wouldn't look at it from the standpoint of the praise or the punishment is really doing anything. And that's always been my philosophy about it. Like, I don't think that the praising fluent speech is really helping the child that much, to be honest with you. And I don't think that praising fluent speech is going to hurt the child that much, to be honest with you, because I don't put that much stock in response contingencies for stuttering, because it's not a learned behavior. And I think if you're taking the approach that, you know, it really does, you're not buying into the response contingency theory, that's okay. But then to say that praising it is not productive, I think it puts a little bit more power behind the response contingency than maybe it deserves, in my opinion.
And see, and I invited you on, and I'm asking these questions knowing your views on Lidcombe, because there's a lot of our colleagues who are very, very pro Lidcombe, and I've had them on Stutter Talk. Some of them, I can't have them all on. But so what concerns me again is that she, in a comment like the one I just read, she's not distinguishing between preschool and school-age children. So a parent who just started Lidcombe with a three-year-old might read this comment and not get it. Or maybe they would get it, and I'm just worried about the message, because I think a parent of a three-year-old who's doing Lidcombe treatment, if they read, I'm going to read the quote again. "I seriously cannot fathom any scenario where it would be appropriate and safe to praise a child for fluent talking." I'm not sure that's appropriate for a parent of a three-year-old to read. I think that Dori should be saying a lot more.
Yeah, I think it's just another example of how there's sort of blanket statements in places without going into the detail to explain those blanket statements. And, you know, I think, again, if I go back to this quote, "I seriously cannot fathom any scenario where it would be appropriate and safe to praise a child for fluent talking." I there's part of me that knows where she's coming from here. And, you know, I think if you have a child, for example, who is really self-aware, self-conscious about their stuttering, really reacting negatively to it, you're going to react and want to approach it very differently than you would for a three-year-old who doesn't really care that they stutter. I think that's the problem, is it's the overgeneralities again.
Yeah, and as an adult, I remember when I started speech therapy and I was working on stuttering openly and stuttering less, and I would get really annoyed when my 23-year-old self would talk and I would have something really important to say, and the person I was speaking to would say, "That was so great, Peter, you didn't stutter once." Like, no, that wasn't the point. You know, I don't want you to tell me if I didn't stutter once. I want you to respond to what I just said. So, I see the kernel of truth in what she's saying. I just, since she's writing so often for parents, I just wish she was more careful. Or maybe another way to say it is I would do it very differently and I would provide a lot more context and be a lot more specific. Okay, so from the Voice Unearthed blog, and we'll link to it from stuttertalk.com, episode 601, Dory Holte has one titled, a blog post, "What I Mean by Real Options." So she discussed this in her book, and I think she's writing more about it on the blog, and she writes, quote, "I challenge support organizations to provide real options to the parents of school-age children who are stuttering." She goes on to write, "Parents deserve to be educated about real options, options that focus on managing speech and using speech tools and techniques, and options that focuses on keeping our kids talking, completely devoid of the toolbox expectation." I mean, isn't that what self-help is doing?
Well, it is, and I think that, you know, what you said before about the program, even back in 2004 from the NSA, really gets to that, because there's a lot of different approaches and options that you mentioned there, in terms of what people have the ability to go learn about. I think if you look at a conference that the NSA puts on, and an ASHA conference, for example, there's a lot of diversity out there in terms of what people are doing, the strengths and limitations of those. Your podcast is another good example of that, where you have people from very different viewpoints on, you know, what we just talked about, Lidcombe. You're going to have people on your show. You've had many on who are pro Lidcombe. You have had many on who are not so much pro Lidcombe. And, you know, that's the resources are out there for people now. And, you know, again, is every SLP going to know about those things? Probably not. But the resources are there to find for the people who are looking.
Yeah, I completely agree. I keep saying that, but I do. I completely agree, Craig. And, you know, when I went to the Friends annual conference in North Carolina in 2015, it was just so awesome. And I was just running around to all different types of workshops. And as I recall, I only heard one person talk about fluency, and that was a child who had it as a personal goal. And the overwhelming amount of everything else was not about fluency, was not about speech tools. There was a voluntary stuttering workshop, but that certainly wasn't about fluency. That was about facing fear and stuttering on purpose. So, I mean, there's just so much out there. And she goes on to write, "This is what I mean by real options, and my challenge to these support organizations is to courageously embrace these different perspectives, respectfully present them side by side, and let parents decide." I don't know. That kind of annoys me. I kind of think these support organizations are doing an amazing job, and they're doing just that. Now, I don't know. Like, what I know we've already talked about it, but what do you make of that conclusion?
Well, there's also some risk in that, to be honest with you. I mean, there would be inherent risk of a support organization, for example, you know, inherently backing or opposing a particular type of treatment. And I think you have to be very careful about that. I mean, you know, so support organizations are there to provide information. They're there to connect people who stutter, to help with support. I'm not really sure I see support organizations as a gatekeeper to research information and to be able to then take that information, decipher it for parents, and put what's best out there for people. I don't know if that's their role.
Yeah, that is a really good point. This is Stutter Talk. My guest today is Craig Coleman. And Craig, I have saved a huge topic for the end. So let me present it to you. Halty reports that after a number of negative therapy experiences, her son, Eli, began working with an eccentric retired professor who owned a horse farm. The overall goal of the, I'm going to call it therapy, was to keep Eli talking. Speech tools were not part of the treatment. Eli was not aware that this was therapy. Halty describes this as a, quote, three-year covert operation. So she was taking him to this retired professor to a, he either was a speech language pathologist or still is. I don't remember. And this sounds like the goal was to just talk and talk and talk with no focus on speech tools without knowing it was therapy and without talking about stuttering. Was that therapy, and what do you think of it?
Well, you know, after what we've talked about today, it would be very hypocritical for me to say that that's not effective, because if it was effective for him, then that's great. And that's all that really matters, is that it was effective for that particular child in doing that. And maybe that's the approach that he needed at that particular time for whatever reason. Now, having said that, I will say that there would be a lot of problematic aspects probably with that type of therapy being provided to most people. Number one, you would have a very difficult time making the argument about why you should be seeing a child for stuttering if you weren't actually talking about stuttering. Now, again, I'm going to agree with her to a certain extent here and say, can you do what she describes in that book in terms of his therapy with the gentleman who was retired at the horse farm? Yes, you can do that in therapy, but I don't think talking about stuttering is the opposite of that, where you can either just never talk about stuttering and just talk, or you have to work on speech tools all the time. I think that there is a strong middle ground that we seem to be missing here about, you can go, you can work on communication, and that be your main focus of therapy, is getting the child to be a better communicator. You can do that while you're talking about stuttering, while you're teaching, educating the child about stuttering, while you're sending the message that it's okay to stutter, and also teaching the kid some strategies that they want to use if they want to use them.
And I think what she's saying in that blog post that we were just talking about, I think what she was saying is that self-help groups should hold up the speech tool approach next to this horse farm approach, where you're just talking and you're not working at all directly on stuttering. And I know you just said that shouldn't be the role of self-help, but I mean, that's quite a stretch, isn't it?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's nothing preventing people who are doing therapy like that to go present on the approach that they're using at a self-help conference or at a national conference of some type. I mean, if somebody wants to present that style of therapy and that type of therapy, I don't think that the NSA, for example, is going to say, no, you can't come here and do that. You know, they can certainly do that, and then people can make the choice about, you know, which way they want to go with it. But I do think that there's in terms of the experience that the person had there, I do think that there is a bit of a caution that I would put out there, which is, you know, it's great to say that you can go see somebody for as long as you want every week, and they're going to come to your house or your horse farm, and you're just going to talk for a while, and you're not going to accept any money for it. That is not the way of the world right now. And if you were going to do that, number one, you wouldn't be able to be in business very long, because you wouldn't make any money and you wouldn't get reimbursed for it. But it also crosses an ethical line to some degree too, that, you know, you're treating somebody without necessarily diagnosing them or treating them. Does that make sense?
No, it does. And, you know, so the folks from the Did I Stutter website, they brought up recently this idea that we should be getting informed consent from preschoolers, from two-year-olds. And I've pushed back strong against that. But this is a informed consent from, I think, this is not even informed consent. This was a boy who I think was 9 years old, who is being taken for 3 years to, again, I don't know if we should call it therapy or not, but I think that the parents certainly saw it as therapy, and wasn't being told it was. And so, I mean, the mom herself said it was covert. So I don't know. I'm not sure what to make of it all. Does that answer you?
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, I think you do run a big risk there with something like that of, maybe it didn't happen in this case, but I think it could blow up in your face. I mean, I think that, you know, if you have a kid going to speech therapy for 2 or 3 years and not really sure why they're going there and never talking about stuttering, that could be a difficult conversation to have with a kid over time if they find out why they're going there.
That is an excellent point. And I'm going to say to you that I'm only aware of two people who might do speech therapy in this way, the person discussed in the book, and there is a speech language pathologist I've met who I've been told does speech therapy in this manner. I invited that person on air and they declined, and I think they declined because they didn't want to be accused of ethical things. I don't want to speak for that person, but that's what I imagine it was about. They didn't want to be challenged. And I understand that. I understand that. And I wish we lived in a world where they felt comfortable coming on air so I could have had a really nice, and I was like really going to just be very polite and just say, you know, there's only two of you doing this, so tell me what it's all about. If she's going to basically reprimand these amazing self-help organizations to provide real options, well, this second option, if there's only two people doing it, or if there's more than two, it's not many more than two, I have to push back and say, are you serious? Like, two people are doing this type of quote therapy, and now the self-help organizations are supposed to hold them up equally? I don't know what you think about that, Craig, but that concerns me.
Well, I think, you know, this really gets to the crux of the book. I mean, you know, it's, as I said earlier, I think that she makes a lot of good points throughout the book. And I think that, you know, it's a really good eye opener for people to see if they are going through negative experiences. And, you know, quite frankly, do we need to do better as a profession in being able to assess and treat children who stutter? Yes, I don't know that there would be many people who would disagree with that as a profession. Now, you know, people who are specialists in it, it's a little bit different. But as a profession, yes, we need to do a better job. But, you know, when you look at the argument that comes back to this with, you know, it almost seems to me at times that the argument that's presented is either you work on speech tools all the time and you go to speech therapy, or you essentially don't ever go to speech therapy and that's a better option. That's the dangerous part of this message to me. Is that, you know, it does send the message sometimes that, well, we did better when we didn't have therapy. And again, that might have been their experience, but I don't think that's the experience that everybody has, and I think that's a dangerous message to send people.
And that's such an insightful thing to say, because if you're pushing back against what you view as the overuse of speech tools, then is it the correct response to say, well, we don't use any speech management at all? And that is a really insightful thing for you to pull out. Okay, I promise you this is the last topic, Craig, because you've been very generous with your time. This is Stutter Talk. Peter Weiss is here with Craig Coleman. Craig is at Marshall University in West Virginia. So In her book on page 58, Holty writes, "It may be no coincidence that once children reach school age and start to fill their toolbox with speech tools focused on changing the way they talk, spontaneous recovery rates plummet." Now, very related to that, from her blog, she has a post, "Keep Her Eye on the Prize." She writes, quote, "I am convinced that recovery rates would soar, maybe up to the 80% spontaneous recovery rate preschoolers experience when therapists focus on helping parents and teachers minimize anxiety around talking and do not attempt to arm children with a toolbox of techniques." I mean, are the tools creating and maintaining the stuttering, Craig?
You know, there's a couple of different points I think I'll make here. Number one is that, and I know I've talked about this before with you, we have to be really careful about the 80% recovery rate. Studies that have shown the recovery rate that high are also pulling in lots of kids who go through periods of just disfluent speech that recover on their own relatively quickly. And, you know, I don't think that what we see in a clinic is that 80% of kids, those kids are recovering on their own without some type of intervention. So you got to be careful at first about the gold standard that you're even using to compare that to. The flip side of that is that we do have those kids out there who have not worked on speech tools for their entire life and who come to us when they're 10, 11, 12 years old for the first time, and they haven't gotten better on their own. In fact, in most cases, they've gotten progressively worse on their own in terms of dealing with stuttering and the reactions to it. So, I think there's a whole control group that's already been out there for a long time that we've seen that come to us later versus earlier. And it's not usually a positive thing when that happens.
Yeah. And she says, "I'm convinced that recovery rates would soar." It really sounds like she's saying these kids would recover if we just didn't treat them. And so I think of my stammering friends in India who tell me that the overwhelming majority of children who stutter don't receive speech therapy in India. And it's not like their recovery rates are higher than ours. You know what I mean? It's not like... it's not like because they don't get treatment, they get better more. You know, I don't know of any evidence that suggests that. So, you know, I find it a little troubling how sure she is that speech therapy is this harmful. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think that's, again, you know, the dangerous part of this is that, you know, for a parent to pick up that and read it and to think, if I don't take my child to speech therapy, their outcome will be better because of that. I think that's a dangerous thing for a parent to think, because, I don't believe that to be true. Like I said, I have seen many, many kids over the years that have come in at 10, 11, 12, 13 for the first time. And those kids do not come in more well-adjusted to their stuttering than a 2 or 3-year-old does in most cases, if they're coming in for the first time ever.
Oh, man, Craig, I didn't get speech therapy until I was in my early 20s. I mean, I think folks claim I did, but I have no memory of it. And I'm pretty sure what happened was the speech therapist would come in the room and sit in the room. Mm-hmm. And so if I have no memory at all of receiving speech therapy, I doubt whether it happened. And I can tell you, facing stuttering on my own was a disaster. Just a disaster. I was miserably unhappy and depressed. And facing stuttering with a very good speech therapist changed my life. So the book we've been discussing with Craig Coleman is Voice Unearthed by Dori Holty. We will... Stutter Talk has invited Dori on air. We will be talking about the strengths of the book, the weaknesses of the book, and I'm so glad, Craig, that you fact-checked this book with me today.
It was a pleasure, Peter, being on, and like I said earlier, I do think it's, there's many positives of the book. I just think we have to use some caution.